School choice has been an explosive issue since the day the term was first coined. It was largely touted as a system that would ensure underprivileged young people would have equal opportunity in education. However, in his new book, Overturning Brown, The Segregationist History of the Modern School Choice Movement, Steve Suit says the rhetoric of the school choice movement resembles that of segregationists who closed public schools and funded private institutions in the wake of the 1954 Brown versus Board of Education decision. For 20 years, Steve Suits has been an adjunct at the Institute for Liberal Arts of Emory University and has been chief strategist for Better Schools, Better Jobs, a Mississippi-based education advocacy project of the New Venture Fund. I asked why he took on this project.
Well, I've been studying and involved in trying to understand the importance of public education for 40 years in my career. This is an issue with which I actually grew up in the 1960s as the South began to desegregate its public schools and private academies began to crop up and expand as a way in which to frustrate desegregation. So it's been an important topic to me personally, but it's also been a central issue in what's kept us from having a more integrated public school system.
We hear the term school choice a lot more lately, too. How would you define that school choice?
Well, I think school choice is simply a private school movement. To some extent, it includes nowadays charter schools among many people. And I think it essentially is school choice means where a private group gets to make decisions about who gets to come to the school and how to run the school, rather than it being decided by public policy.
I want to read here a quote that you had from 1954 Alabama. What could be more American than the freedom of parents to choose their children's schools, private or public, with public financial support? Now, if a politician did that today, it would be an applause line.
It certainly would be. You know, Bob, we think about the segregationists who created this system of vouchers in the context of defeating integration of the public schools. We think of them in the image of George Wallace as people who stand up and proclaim segregation today, segregation forever, when in fact the segregationists who designed the systems of resistance, of which vouchers were a major part, they were very sophisticated people, very smart people in many instances, who designed a system and a language which today is adopted by the people who say that school choice is a movement for social justice rather than an effort to defeat desegregated public education.
Do some voucher programs actually give minority or poor students opportunities they otherwise wouldn't have?
Oh, yes, they do. They did in the 1960s as well in the segregated schools. For example, in Louisiana, a significant number of African-American students in New Orleans were given vouchers. There were many of the programs across the 1960s in the segregated South gave any student a chance to go to a private school with a voucher, and a significant number of black students chose that. But that was always the exception, as it is today across the country. It's always the exception, not the rule. The rule is that most private schools in the United States, and certainly in the South, are deeply segregated, are exclusionary, and they accept only a small token number of students of color. That is the system we now find that 26 states, a majority of the states in the country, now publicly finance private schooling, often with very little regulation. In the 1960s, we had only six southern states that were primarily in the business of financing private schools. We now have 26. This is a problem.
Were many of the voucher programs that started in the segregated South, did they hold up to court muster?
Some did and some didn't. Essentially, what happened was that it became clear that the private schools were going to have to admit a token number of students of color in order to pass legal muster. And so they did. The segregationists who designed some of these systems essentially said, we can no longer have what some called a no, not one black student segregation. We've got to admit a few in order to maintain white control and the white culture of our school. And so they began to admit a token number, and that token number over time in some places did not satisfy the federal courts. But as the Supreme Court changed, it began to satisfy the courts that a token number was evidence that this was not a segregated school. We had then, in the 1960s and into the 70s, schools that were virtually segregated, and most of the private schools today are still virtually segregated.
Back in those early days, were many of those schools religiously affiliated?
They emerged in that way. They were not all that many began, although there were quite a few churches, all white churches, that began private academies in order to have the white children in their churches go to only all white schools. Over time, there began to be a merger between the intentions of segregation and the intentions of providing a religious education. And there's you'll see in my book a quote from one of the heads of one of the state private school associations in the 1970s saying that they wanted to give a religious education because God ordained that that the races should be segregated. But even then, it was usually the exception where a religious education was not also a segregated, a virtually segregated education as well.
Were those religious schools able to use vouchers back then?
Not often. In the South, the programs prohibited the use of vouchers for religious schools. Once those particular voucher programs were declared unconstitutional in the 60s, the new voucher programs have generally permitted religious education to be financed by public funds.
And in the book, it seems you point to Ronald Reagan as a turning point for that, for more religious schools getting money.
That's right. I think President Reagan, he took the position once he was elected in 1980 and across the 1980s that the issues of segregation had been settled and what we needed was more religious education and that the federal government should start financing private schools to provide religious education. And this merger of segregation and religion became really very closely intertwined during the 1980s.
And the court has allowed that to go on, hasn't it?
It has. It has. The court has evolved since the court of the 1960s. In 1970, Justice Rehnquist, who later became Chief Justice Rehnquist, was the first member of the court in the 1970s to dissent from enforcing the Brown decision of 1954. It just so happens that Justice Rehnquist, when he was a clerk at the court in 1954, argued, we know from the archives, argued that Brown versus Board should not overturn Plessy versus Ferguson, which was the decision in 1896 that held that separate but equal was constitutional. And, of course, since 1896, it was very rare that separate was ever equal, and it certainly wasn't in 1954, and it wasn't in 1974 when Justice Rehnquist dissented. I might mention there's a big case before the Supreme Court right now. It may be decided before the middle of July. But the court generally has permitted financing of religious schools and has blocked the individual plaintiffs, African Americans and others, from being able to have standing in court to challenge whether or not these this financing meets the Constitution. So in some ways, it's not only that they've permitted it, they've disallowed any individuals to bring a lawsuit to challenge it.
So have some of those original old schools that just started out after Brown, are they some of them still around?
Oh, yes. Most of the private schools in the South, certainly, and a large number across the country, in fact, either started during this period of segregation or grew considerably, expanded during that period, so that the legacy is such, I think it would be a great enterprise for students in private schools today to examine the origins of their school and what role it has played in either advancing or barring and frustrating desegregation of our schools so that different people go to the same school.
So much has been written, and of course in your book too, that this is a Southern phenomenon. But it did happen nationwide, didn't it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You know, it's quite interesting that, for example, in places like Arizona, they had segregated laws. What's interesting about that is that in Arizona, for example, they started out permitting token segregation, token integration. But if you got too many non-white students in a school, then there was a mechanism in which to create absolute segregation, barring all people, students who were of color from the school. In the South, we had exactly the opposite. We had absolute segregation by law, but then once the challenges began, we began allowing token integration. And so, yes, it wasn't entirely a Southern phenomenon then, although vouchers were only used in the South. And it's certainly not a Southern phenomenon today alone.
I'm just smiling here because you don't include Arizona as part of the South. Now, you are a Southerner, my friend.
That's right. You know, they used to call that part of the Sun Belt, but I've never been able to figure out where the Sun Belt begins and ends, because I think it actually has, they actually have sun in Massachusetts.
We'll just call it the desert and make it a day. Call it a day. That's okay. So is the trend going to continue? Do you see any change coming?
Well, I think we have to have in this country, and maybe we've begun to have in recent weeks, a reawakening of the importance of giving each child an equal opportunity and the importance of having a democratic school system in which all are welcomed and all are treated well, and not having a publicly financed system of education in which individuals get to choose people on the basis of race or religion or sexual orientation or any of those what we think of today and generally agree are irrational bases for deciding who should be included and who should be excluded. It all gets back, I think, Bob, to what Justice Thurgood Marshall wrote in a dissent back in 1974, and it was a prophetic, eloquent statement, and it was, unless our children begin to learn together, there is little hope that our people will ever learn to live together. I think it's that fundamental and that important.
Again, the name of Steve Suit's new book is Overturning Brown, The Segregationist History of the Modern School Choice Movement. Still to come, a new coronavirus highlights the need for new ways to develop tests. That story's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. When the COVID-19 pandemic first hit, the scientific community went into overdrive trying to find a way to test for the disease. Those tests were quickly developed. However, commercially available test kits were in scarce supply and heavy demand. That's where laboratory-developed tests, or LDTs, come in. These tests are internally developed and validated at the performing laboratory. An editorial published in the Journal of Applied Laboratory Medicine highlights the value of laboratory-developed develop tests in the context of the COVID-19 pandemic and warns of the dangers of overregulation of diagnostics. The author of the article is Dr. Dennis Dietzen, a professor of pathology and immunology and pediatrics at the Washington University School of Medicine and is medical director of laboratory services at St. Louis Children's Hospital. I asked him to give us some background on laboratory-developed tests.
Sure, I'd be happy to. So LDTs, the old-fashioned name for these tests, were homebrew tests, and some people still refer to them as such. But they're tests that are developed by individual laboratories, usually for a restricted local population. And what that means is all the ingredients, all the instrumentation that's necessary to perform a test is collected and put together by the laboratorians. And then the test is validated on site and is maintained on site. So there are commercial reagents within those tests, but those reagents are deployed in an expert way by experienced laboratory technologists and scientists to make a laboratory test out of them. So it's not something you buy off the shelf that's got all the ingredients in it and you push a button and make it happen. So it's much more complicated than that. So that's typically what they are. In my experience, they're used in at least three different situations. They are used in situations where there are no FDA-cleared or FDA-approved tests. I happen to work in a children's hospital, so the rare metabolic diseases that we diagnose, nearly all of the testing that's done to diagnose and follow those patients has to be done with laboratory-developed tests because there are simply no other alternatives to those tests. Other circumstances where you might find yourself needing a laboratory-developed test are if you have an FDA-approved test, but you know it has a significant flaw in it. You will not want to use that FDA-approved test. So what you might end up doing is creating your own test or modifying that FDA-approved test to serve better in your clinical population. So it might be as simple as running a set of reagents on an open channel on one of your automated chemistry analyzers. But again, you may be using a commercial piece of equipment and some commercial reagents, but you have varied that test enough that you need to redefine its performance characteristics and its diagnostic characteristics. So that's situation number two. Situation number three, I think, is maybe the most important, and that is laboratorians sit at the interface between medicine and technology. And within that interface, laboratorians know when there's a significant advance in the diagnosis or treatment of a disorder that may require a new test to help the physicians either prescribe treatment or follow the course of that disease. So that's the third situation, is in those gaps that develop in the pace of our improvement in the pathophysiology, understanding the pathophysiology of disease these days, is tremendous. So laboratorians are charged with a lot of things, and one of the things we should be doing is monitoring the development of medicine and then plugging in diagnostics where they need to be plugged in.
So how are FDA-approved diagnostic tests different from LDTs?
So FDA-cleared or FDA-approved diagnostic tests are typically manufactured by companies that have a large installed instrument base, and they have to scale up the production of reagents to supply those instruments, and they're supplied nationwide and they're supplied worldwide. So as part of the FDA approval process, the performance characteristics of those assays are gleaned from clinical studies, but the FDA approval process is also one that monitors the manufacturing capability of those reagents. So multiple lots might be used in those studies. How accurate are those reagents from lot to lot? How precise are those reagents from lot to lot? Some FDA-approved tests are approved on the basis of their equivalence to a pre-existing FDA-approved test. But some FDA-approved tests go through a process called a pre-market authorization, or PMA, or pre-market approval. And those tests go through a little more rigorous clinical diagnostic accuracy assessment as well. LDTs, today, they're built and validated in a single laboratory for usually a restricted set of patients. So all of the analytic performance characteristics and the clinical performance characteristics are determined by the performing laboratory, and the FDA is typically not involved in that at this point.
Are FDA-approved tests safer to use than LDTs?
I think that's what some people would have you believe. Is the FDA process very rigorous, and are those FDA-approved tests very safe? Yes, they are. but LDTs also are. There are many, many LDTs that are in service today, and thousands of tests every day get performed by LDTs. And if you look hard enough, you can find situations where LDTs have been misused. Sometimes, you know, the validation process is at fault. Sometimes there's a communication with physicians that's not optimal that causes physicians to misinterpret those results. But FDA-approved tests also have faults. A decade or so ago, there was a problem with an HCG assay by one of the commercial manufacturers that caused the false positive pregnancy diagnosis or false positive possibilities of tumors. And so this caused a big problem. And every year there are dozens and dozens and dozens of FDA recalls every year on those reagents. So there's a lot of safeguards built into FDA-approved diagnostics, but they're not perfect. And the 510K process, as it's known, which is used in situations where a manufacturer can gain approval by comparing itself to a pre-existing FDA-approved diagnostic, if that pre-existing FDA-approved diagnostic is itself faulty, then you actually proliferate the problem in the FDA-approved test. So I don't think it's fair to say that FDA-approved tests are safer than LDTs. There's risk in both setups.
Well, finally, Doctor, what role have LDTs played in the current COVID-19 pandemic?
I think the current situation, and one of the things that prompted me to write the editorial for the Journal of Applied Laboratory Medicine, was the spotlight that LDTs should get in this set of circumstances. So usually LDTs are performed on a very small subset of patients, for example, for rare diseases. But in this pandemic, the development and the light shown on LDTs has been particularly intense because of this pandemic. Early on in the pandemic, the only reagents made available to do diagnostic testing for the novel coronavirus COVID-19 were distributed to public health laboratories, and the supply was not great. It turns out there was some contamination in some of those reagents that hindered their development and hindered their use. So what happened is a lot of laboratories in really record-breaking time sourced reagents from various manufacturers to extract nucleic acid, to amplify nucleic acid, and detect the right amplified PCR products to detect COVID-19. And this all happened. You know, sometimes LDTs can take weeks to months to years to develop, and this all happened in a matter of days to weeks. And those LDTs, the local LDTs, in many academic medical centers and in many private laboratories, have been the only eyes that public health officials have had on the development of this test. The results from this test are incredibly important in determining how to treat patients, how to isolate patients, and how to deploy caregivers in these situations with the proper protective equipment on them so they can know who they're treating and if they're infected or not. So the role that LDTs have played in this current pandemic cannot be overstated any more than I'm doing right now. It's just been incredibly important, and it has been the only eyeballs that we've had on most of this pandemic for a long time. Now, there are a number of commercial reagents approved under emergency use authorization by the FDA that are now coming into the marketplace that are helping with the capacity to test. And importantly, the reopening of a lot of the economic activity of the country is going to depend on our capacity to do a lot more of these tests.
Dr. Dennis Dietzen is a professor of pathology and immunology and pediatrics at the Washington University School of Medicine and is the medical director of laboratory services at St. Louis Children's Hospital. His editorial is available online now and will appear in the September 2020 issue of the Journal of Applied Laboratory Medicine. Earlier, we spoke about continued segregation in some private schools, but inequality still exists everywhere. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Racial discrimination can be hidden in less visible places. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Deborah Archer, associate professor of clinical law, explores this statement.
When we think of Jim Crow, we usually imagine relics of the past, such as police dogs and whites-only water fountains. Those laws are gone, but many Americans remain committed to racial inequality. In my research, I want to understand the ways that America's history of state-mandated segregation continues to affect our lives. but I also want to show that government-enforced racial discrimination is alive and well in America, albeit in less visible and obvious forms. Crime-free housing ordinances are one example. These laws encourage or require landlords to evict or exclude tenants who have had varying degrees of contact with the criminal legal system. They have the purported goal of stemming crime in rental housing, but the truth is that they are more effective at excluding racial minorities and promoting racial segregation. While the Fair Housing Act of 1968 prohibits racial discrimination in housing, many in the real estate industry continue to skirt the law. For example, a 2019 investigation revealed that real estate agents in Long Island were steering people of color towards neighborhoods with higher minority populations. Crime-free housing ordinances act in more subtle ways. By empowering or requiring landlords to evict or exclude people with criminal legal system contacts, including those who have been arrested without conviction or even those simply suspected of wrongdoing by the police, crime-free housing ordinances effectively merge the racial bias of the criminal legal system with housing policy and blur the line between housing determinations and policing. This follows the Jim Crow playbook. The myth of black criminality was used to justify many Jim Crow laws. White people justified the creation of whites-only spaces, such as schools, neighborhoods, and parks, by perpetuating narratives of black criminality. Crime-free ordinances fit squarely into this history.
That was Deborah Archer of New York University. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. And you can find us on Twitter at TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.